It's the Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. The name Jeremy Resnick has become synonymous with Propel schools and in a very real way with charter schools in general in the Pittsburgh region. The co-founder of Propel Schools is stepping down from his role as executive director of the Propel Schools Foundation to take on a new role. Jeremy Resnick joins us in studio. Welcome to the Confluence.
Thank you, Kevin. Nice to be here.
So when you co-founded Propel in 2003 in Homestead, I believe it was in a former hospital. Is that correct?
Yep, we were in the basement of a hospital.
Okay. Did you really think it would expand to this, or was it just a dream, a goal, and a hope that it would grow into a network of, was it 13 schools, 4,000 students now?
Yeah, I think it's all those things. It was a dream. It was a voyage. It was a dream of a lot of people in the community and parents. And it's very exciting when something that you dream about and work hard on, when lots of people work hard, they can make great things happen.
But why did you think it was possible? What did you sense that might make it possible that it would be a success to expand?
Well, I know one thing for sure is that parents care a lot about their children and they want better things for their children. And I know and knew from conversations with parents in the Pittsburgh area that many of them were looking for public schools that they didn't have access to. And the idea of creating those schools so that they would have access to them just made sense.
Mm-hmm. Prior to Propel, you were a founder, administrative, and education leader at Northside Urban Pathways Charter School, and before that, a founder of the Charter Schools Project at Duquesne University. You were also a teacher in Pittsburgh Public Schools. How did all that experience help you when it came to devising charter schools, the mission, even the curricula?
Well, I think everybody's life experience leads them to different places. I've spent pretty much my whole life in schools. I think it helped me in recognizing the talent that is needed in order to have a great school. And we were able to put together a really tremendous team at Propel. We still have a tremendous team at Propel. And when you get great people together that understand how children learn, what motivates families, what motivates children, you end up with a great outcome.
Mm-hmm. Was that a math teacher in Pittsburgh Public Schools?
I was a math teacher.
What grade level?
High school.
Okay.
Yep.
So what led you to the conclusion that charters might be best or a good alternative? Why not try to improve within the public school system that existed?
I mean, we do. I think lots of great people are working to improve the school districts. I think that's tremendously important. Charter schools aren't a silver bullet. On the other hand, I believe that all families should have choice, not just families that have affluence, which, you know, people say, should we have choice or shouldn't we have choice? We've had choice in American education for hundreds of years. But only affluent families had those choices. Only affluent families could choose to move to a Mount Lebanon or an Upper St. Clair, or could camp out to get their kids into a magnet school. And the charter school idea has just been a great leveling movement of equity that's provided choice to all families. And that's just personally something that resonated with me.
Mm. One of the intentions of the charter school law passed by the legislature in 1997 was for charter schools to share best practices with their home districts. Would you say there has been a sharing, either voluntarily or because it's what lawmakers wanted? How would you put it?
Well, they always say, watch what I do, not what I say. If you want your child to watch you, your children are going to be watching what you do. And I think that's the case in the charter school sector. Lots of people are watching what we do. Lots of the things that we do at Propel are being emulated in district schools. And that's fine. And we've seen full-day kindergarten come to all districts in Allegheny County. When we started Propel, many districts didn't have full-day kindergarten. Mm-hmm. We've seen lots of programs that started at Propel move into some of the school districts where our students live.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned the all-day kindergarten as an example. Yep. Can you expand upon that, how public school districts might have emulated something, whether it's a particular curriculum or whatever that Propel was doing that they sort of, hey, this might work with us as well.
Yeah, I mean, a great example of that is in the Woodland Hills School District, the Woodland Hills Academy, which the school district in Woodland Hills never had a magnet school until Propel came along. They created the Woodland Hills Academy. It's been very popular, very successful in the Woodland Hills School District, and it's a great option for families there. And many of the features that they have at the Academy were drawn from what they saw us doing at Propel East, and that's great.
Do you think that was from what they saw at Propel or magnet schools in Pittsburgh Public Schools? Or, I mean,
I'm not a mind reader, so I don't know what's in their mind. I do know that the situation, the landscape in public education that includes charters is substantially better now, that landscape, that ecosystem, than it was 20 years ago when the charter school law first came. overall performance is up, graduation rates are up, families have access to schools. And I think when families are sort of active consumers, you see school districts, you see charter schools, you see everybody getting better.
Okay. A state house committee has moved a group of bills to the full house that would significantly change how Pennsylvania oversees its charter schools. One would streamline the application process, which requires a traditional public district sign off on a charter's existence. I'm just curious, you're not involved in that anymore as you are transitioning roles, and I want to talk a little bit about that in a moment or two. But what have you learned through the years? What do you take away from the charter application process that currently exists?
I don't have a whole lot of exciting insights into that. I think when you're establishing a new public school, you definitely want to make sure that there's a credible team that has a credible plan before you open the doors. I think it's important that be vetted. On the other hand, I also think it's important that you have organizations doing that vetting that are actually looking and want to have more good schools available to families. If you have a process that's limited to school districts that don't want any new options available outside of what the district itself provides, I think that creates kind of a toxic environment.
What would you tell a charter school developer now? I mean, you developed several charter schools. Someone who wanted to start a school like you did, what advice would you give them?
I would encourage them to build a great team of educators and listen to what parents are looking for and be responsive to that.
Mm-hmm. It's Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Our guest is Jeremy Resnick, co-founder of Propel Schools, who is transitioning to a new position with Fund My Future. I'm going to ask you about that in a sec, but do you think charters have done all they can for parents and kids in Pennsylvania? What more can they do?
Well, I think they can continue to provide great school options that are responsive to the desires that parents have. I think parents are great consumers. Parents can walk through a school and look at how teachers are interacting with children. Children are interacting with children, and they can decide very quickly and with great, great clarity what would make a good school for their child. And as long as the charter school movement continues to provide choices that families find responsive to their needs, then charter schools are going to be doing a great thing for our community.
Jeremy, what's the role, what's the purpose of Fund My Future?
Well, Fund My Future is one of the programs that Propel started for its own families to encourage parents to set up savings accounts for their children. There's lots of things parents can do for their kids that are hard, lots of things like teach your child to read, but some things, that small things that you can do for your child, like setting up a savings account, have outsized returns. And the research on that is really kind of startling. Children that have savings accounts in their name are 3 times more likely to go to college, 4 times more likely to complete, even when you factor in things like family income, family education. And that's because savings is a concrete embodiment of hope. And when you set up a savings account for your child, you're telling them that you believe in the future. Might not have a lot of money, but I believe that you're going to have a future, and this money is a concrete embodiment of that. So we've been working to get families to set up savings accounts, and we've been quite successful in that.
We have just a couple of minutes left. How's this different, say, from Pennsylvania's 529 savings plan for parents for their kids' college education?
Well, Fund My Future is a community-wide movement to get families to open up savings accounts. The 529 plan is one savings vehicle. You could do that. You could go to a bank and set up a savings account there. We're kind of agnostic about how you do that, but big believers that doing that is something very important.
And you're trying just to get people to be aware and start now rather than waiting until the early years of high school.
Yeah, I mean, in the last couple of years, we've expanded the program to be open to all Allegheny County residents. We've had about 1,300 families, about 100 families a month signing up for the program. We make it fun. We have raffle prizes. And in any given month, a quarter of the families are making a deposit into a savings account. And we're very excited about that. And we're very excited that the participants reflect Allegheny County's demographics. They include low-income families. They include moderate-income families, white, black. It's very exciting.
In our last 30 seconds or so, what do you see for the future of charter schools and even the relationships with public school districts?
Well, I think we come to a generation of leaders in the district schools and in charter schools that are used to working with each other, that don't see each other as adversaries, that recognize that we're both part of the public school ecosystem in Pennsylvania and elsewhere. And I think that creates more opportunities for families for working together to tackle the needs of the community and make sure that every child has access to a great public school.
Jeremy Resnick was one of the driving forces behind the creation and expansion of charter schools in Western Pennsylvania, and he's now working with Fund My Future to help parents and kids prepare for higher education. Jeremy, thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks for having me, Kevin.
I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
I'm Kylie Kaczynski. Still ahead on The Confluence, we'll hear from the candidates seeking a spot on the city school board ahead of the May 21st primary. And the closing of local newsrooms around the country has created a number of areas with limited access to news outlets known as news deserts. Point Park University has announced a fellowship that seeks to address this problem locally. Get conversations, stories, and more from this and past episodes of The Confluence at wesa.fm/confluence.
B.B. King bought his first guitar when he was just 12 years old. Now, that particular axe cost him just $15, but another guitar years later would almost cost him his life. While performing at a dance hall in 1949, two men began fighting and knocked over a kerosene heater, setting fire to the hall. The crowd was evacuated, but King ran back in to get his beloved Gibson guitar. He got out safely and learned that the men were fighting over a woman named Lucille. King decided to name all of his guitars Lucille as a reminder to himself to never do anything that foolish. He passed away on this day in 2015. For 91.3 WYEP, I'm Joey Spehar.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Gas prices in Pennsylvania have been creeping up, with many stations in the Pittsburgh region now well above $3 per gallon. But why do gas prices climb just before you get ready to leave for vacation? We're talking to AAA spokesman Jim Garrity. Jim, thanks so much for taking the time.
Yeah, glad to be here. This is definitely a relevant topic this time of year.
Jim, you got some new figures. What kind of prices are we seeing right now? You just got these numbers.
Well, as of this week in Western Pennsylvania, we're looking at gasoline that is an average of $3.08. And that's pretty much from Erie all the way down to the bottom of the state on the western half. And statewide, we're looking at gasoline that's about $3.02, and it's about 3 cents cheaper over the week.
Jim, despite that small drop overall, there's been a steady increase, right? So why so?
What we've been seeing happening is a few things, and probably the biggest of which is a yearly occurrence that we see every year, and that is a lot of refineries that supply our gasoline go offline, and they start to produce that summer blend gasoline, which is different from winter blend, both environmentally and Technically speaking, it performs differently within the engine. So you have that gasoline is being produced, it's being sold to distributors, and it's more expensive to produce, so it's more expensive to buy. That's one of the largest things that happens every year. And also on top of that, you have demand has been increasing. Some good news, it looks like, in our region is that refinery utilization, which is the industry way of saying the amount of refineries that are currently making gasoline, does look like the planned and unplanned maintenance is wrapping up, and that should help push that refinery utilization upwards, which could mean more gasoline, which means more supply, and potentially more stable prices, potentially even coming down.
All right, so you mentioned the summer blend, but really about how much does that add per gallon, the actual cost of the summer blend?
They can fluctuate, and they can fluctuate even county by county. But looking at, I mean, you look at gasoline that can go up upwards of 20, 30, 40 cents. And that summer blend gasoline is like I said, part environmental and part functional. As long as there's a summer and as long as there's a winter, there's always going to be a summer and winter blend gasoline, because when the weather gets colder, you need that gasoline to be able to turn an engine over at potentially zero or even below zero. And at the same rate, when it gets hot out, you need that gasoline to be able to hold its own and not evaporate as easily. But then in addition to that, it's summer. And, you know, according to our AAA research that we've been seeing this year, more Americans are planning on taking trips, which means longer road trips, which means more demand, which means prices increasing on the back of that as well.
Pennsylvania is among the top 10 states for highest gas prices in the nation. Other than having the highest gas tax in the nation, is there a reason it's more expensive in Pennsylvania compared to neighboring states such as Ohio?
Well, a big problem in Pennsylvania when it comes to our gasoline being more expensive is our proximity to where the gasoline is coming from. If you looked at a map of Pennsylvania, the left-hand side where we are, the western side, is far more expensive than, let's say, over in the Philadelphia area. Here in Pittsburgh, we're getting a lot of our gasoline from Ohio. We're getting a lot of it from refineries over there. But, you know, on the other side of the state in Philadelphia, there are, I think, three refineries in Philadelphia alone. So proximity to resources is one thing, but you can't gloss over the gasoline tax, because having the highest gasoline tax in the country is a major player, if not the largest player, at our gasoline compared to our neighboring states.
Jim Garrity is from AAA. Thanks so much, Jim.
Absolutely. Anytime.
I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Candidates running for a seat on Pittsburgh Public Schools Board have spent the last few months knocking on doors, putting up signs, seeking endorsements, and answering questions at community forums. 90.5 WESA's Sarah Schneider reports that the nine candidates have big questions to answer ahead of the May 21st primary.
Questions like, how should teachers be evaluated? How will the district reduce the achievement gap between students of color and white students? And how will the board balance a $650 million budget as the district depletes its reserve fund? The candidates are seeking unpaid positions that come with a lot of responsibility. The board approves the budget and enacts policies that determine everything from curricula to how its 24,000 students are disciplined. In District 4, two candidates are engaged in a highly competitive, high-profile race that has garnered endorsements from several organizations and political leaders. Both have hired consultants, each has raised about $33,000, and the neighborhoods they represent are engaged in a battle of lawn signs.
I'm somebody who knows how to move policy.
That's Pam Harbin. She's been an education advocate for a dozen years and co-founded the Education Rights Network, a parent-led organization. She has two kids in Pittsburgh Public Schools.
I am somebody who knows how to work in collaboration with a lot of different people in the city to make positive change, and I think change can happen. It has to happen.
Harbin says public education has been defunded, which means students are losing social workers, librarians, and the arts. Harbin has been endorsed by the Teachers Union, among others. District 4 is now represented by Board President Linda Wren and includes Squirrel Hill, Point Breeze, and parts of Oakland and Shadyside. Candidate Anna Batista calls herself a builder who will look at data to help improve the institution. She says collaboration is important for the future of the district.
How well can we work with the city, with academic institutions, with the nonprofit organizations out there trying to help PPS students? And I think that I have a very good track record of productive collaborations, of working constructively with people, even when I disagree with them.
Batista is a senior consultant at High Street Consulting. She's worked for a decade in finance and public sector policy analysis. She is a mother of three. Her oldest attends PPS. She has the support of Mayor Bill Peduto and Allegheny County Executive Rich Fitzgerald, among others. She notes that nearly half of PPS students cannot read at grade level by third grade, an issue she says should be addressed collectively.
What are the levers that can actually start to produce change? Trying to identify those. And then looking elsewhere at places that have started to see improvements in reading outcomes, other urban districts, and ask what are the levers that are making that change there? And then what can we replicate here in Pittsburgh?
Harbin says she wants to focus on providing safe and supportive schools. She wants to expand the community schools model, which requires a coordinator who brings social services into a building to help students who face trauma or are disadvantaged.
If we are not addressing those issues through community schools models or looking at the ratio of counselors and social workers to students, making sure that we have somebody in the school building that can work with families if they need help or an advocate to understand something about the system, then we really can't improve the teaching and learning environment to what it needs to be.
Several other candidates, including Batista, have also said they want to expand community schools. It's a bigger pool in District 2, where four people are looking to take the place of longtime board member and former educator Regina Holly. That area includes Highland Park, Lawrenceville, East Liberty, Bloomfield, and parts of the North Side. David Atkinson is an IT professional at the University of Pittsburgh and is the parent of three. As a board member on the Highland Park Community Council, he helped improve the intersection near Obama Academy. He wants to evaluate and address the district's declining enrollment.
That's where I believe if we have an independent commission, look at the district as a whole, evaluate the programming options, including magnet and school configuration, meaning is it K through 5 or 6 through 8, and devise a plan that's going to attract families back into our schools and grow our school enrollment.
Nosakari Griffin L. has a PhD in education that focuses on policymaking. He's a parent of two young children and co-coordinates a monthly reading program at his local library. If he were elected, he says he would want two students on the board as voting members.
We just can't have students' voice as a tool to develop policy. We have to have students on the board expressing their ideas, both verbally and within the committee, so that policy could be developed that meet them at their needs and at their dreams for themselves and their entire student body.
Kirk Rise is another Pittsburgh Public parent looking to represent District 2. The former Peace Corps volunteer is now general counsel for BNY Mellon. He wants high-quality schools for all students, which he says starts with quality leaders. He would prioritize creating a principal pipeline.
Maybe move some of the budget we have away from some of the administration over to building that, paying to identify, to train, and then to support new principals. Because my experience right now is that strong principals do a great job.
Devin Telefaro is a program assistant with Big Brothers Big Sisters of Greater Pittsburgh. She coordinates a mentorship program at Brashear High School. She wants the teacher demographic to reflect the students.
Making sure that we have a diverse pool of teachers and that we're building partnerships with whether it be historically Black colleges and universities to pull for more educators that are graduating from college.
Across the Monongahela, two candidates are competing to represent South Hills neighborhoods, including Brookline, Beachview, and Mount Washington. Heather Fulton has twin daughters in Alderdice High School. She's lived in Brookline for more than 20 years. One of her top priorities is to improve early childhood literacy rates. She says she doesn't think the community knows that the district offers pre-kindergarten programs.
We need to have more. There is already over 90 childcare pre-K centers available, and there's still so many people that need it.
Bill Gallagher taught and coached in Pittsburgh Public Schools for 27 years. He's lived in Brookline his whole life. He says there needs to be a sense of urgency when it comes to improving early literacy and creating smaller classes.
Why are we not having almost like a SWAT team attack with teachers in these schools? Why are these kindergarten first graders in a classroom with 19 with reading deficits?
Incumbent Kevin Carter is running unopposed in District 8, covering Northside neighborhoods. District 2 and 4 candidates could face off again in November, as some have cross-filed on both the Democratic and Republican ballots. I'm Sarah Schneider, 90.5 WESA News.
And I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
I'm Megan Harris. The Confluence airs live from 9 to 10 a.m., but the news never stops. Find more stories, conversations, and more on our website at wesa.fm/confluence, on Twitter at WESAConfluence, and wherever you get your podcasts. The Confluence continues next on 90.5 WESA.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Work continues as the city replaces a block of Grant Street in downtown Pittsburgh, brick by brick, literally. Joining us now is Eric Setzler, Chief Engineer for the Department of Mobility and Infrastructure for the City of Pittsburgh. Eric, thanks so much for taking the time.
Well, thanks for having me.
So, Eric, this is part of a multi-year process for rehabilitating Grant Street, is it not?
It is, yes. This year we identified the block there between 7th and Liberty as the section of Grant that is in the worst condition. So we wanted to get out there and repair that section. But in future years, we plan to identify other areas and do similar kinds of work.
This section of Grant Street is going to take a couple of months to do. People are wondering, why so long? Is that strictly because it is made of bricks?
Replacing the bricks will take a while. So what we've done so far is we have removed all of the old bricks and cleaned all that up, and then we have gone through, and there's a concrete base beneath the brick. So we have inspected the concrete base, and we've identified the areas that are damaged, and we want to rip out that concrete and put in new concrete. When all that is done, there will be a thin layer of asphalt that goes down, and then the bricks set on the asphalt leveling course.
So anyone who's driven along Grant Street, they know how beautiful it can be when it's in good shape. But why does the city maintain a brick street?
The decision was first made, I believe it was the late 80s or around 1990, that we are going to put some extra investment into Grant Street, really just because of its prominence in downtown. It's a main thoroughfare. It connects from the city-county building and the county courthouse all the way up to the federal courthouse and the federal building. So it's really just a prominent street, an important street in downtown Pittsburgh. So we're giving a little extra treatment because of that.
So in other words, sort of like a signature street for downtown Pittsburgh?
Yeah, I think that's a good way to look at it.
The bricks that you're replacing in this one block of Grant Street between 7th and Liberty, about how old are they?
So the original street construction was completed in 1990, so almost 30 years. There have been spot repairs in the interim, but I'm pretty sure that most of these are original.
And that would be about how old?
About 30 years.
Do I assume correctly that it's more costly than using concrete or replacing the street with asphalt?
It is, absolutely. I mean, just the bricks, we have to buy the bricks, that's a little bit more expensive, and then just the labor involved to set all the bricks, one by one and get them all locked in there tightly. So it's definitely an extra cost.
But on the other hand, are they more durable? You said that some of these bricks are 30 years old. Are they more durable than concrete or asphalt?
Sure, they are durable. I mean, a concrete road is also a pretty durable solution, but both the brick and the concrete will have a much longer life than asphalt. For some of our busier streets, asphalt typically needs to be resurfaced every maybe 7 years, maybe even more frequent for some of the heaviest trafficked routes.
Eric, I have to ask you personally, as chief engineer for the city, is this project because it's different from all the other roads you have to deal with in the city, it's a little more exciting.
It is, yeah. You know, it is exciting to be on a job where we're doing something that we don't do all the time. And, you know, it's kind of special to work on something like that. And it does, you know, it creates a nice a signature look for that section of our downtown.
And again, you're not just pouring concrete or asphalt. So are the bricks laid down one at a time by hand?
Yeah, they'll have to be put in, you know, one by one after the concrete and the asphalt are there. So that's, you know, that's where some of the time is involved and certainly some of the extra cost as well.
Is this your version of a jigsaw puzzle?
Yeah, yep. Luckily, all the pieces look alike.
Eric Setzler is the chief engineer for the Department of Mobility and Infrastructure for the City of Pittsburgh. Eric, thanks so much for taking the time.
Well, thanks for having me.
I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Megan Harris. Point Park University is awarding $20,000 for an investigative journalism fellowship that addresses the problem of news deserts. The application deadline is June 30th, and Andrew Conti is hoping for a few innovative ideas. He's the director of Point Park's Center for Media Innovation. Andy, welcome back to The Confluence.
Thanks for having me on.
So $20,000 to fill the gaps in a place lacking for local news. How did the idea for a fellowship like this come together?
We're excited about it. We think that this kind of money could be a game changer. The idea started with the university. We wanted to give some sort of a national award or fellowship. And so we went to the funder, the Allegheny Foundation, and proposed the idea to them. And they came back with the idea to name it for Doris O'Donnell, who's somebody who was a close friend of Dick Scaife, who was the owner of the Tribune Review, and who, you know, left his money to the Allegheny Foundation. And when we started looking at Doris O'Donnell, who she was and what she did, we were like, yeah, this is a great idea. Let's put her name on it and let's put the money out there. And I think for us, the exciting thing is at a time when journalism is going through so many cutbacks and newspapers are disappearing and closing, to be able to do something that will give some money to a journalist to go and do a story in one of these areas, we hope will be a game changer.
You mentioned Doris O'Donnell. She was a reporter in Cleveland and at the Greensburg Tribune Review for a time. Tell us about who she was.
Yeah, so Doris is actually really famous in Cleveland. Like if you were from Cleveland, you were like, oh yeah, Doris O'Donnell. People recognize her name there. It's like a household name. She was somebody who was a pioneering journalist when, you know, in this period in the second half of the 20th century when there were not a lot of women journalists. And one of the things she did was she had a job where she would do these stunt stories where she would go out and try different jobs. So she was like a welder one time, and she, I think, worked as a warden in a jail and like just like different jobs that women weren't doing. And so she was doing those jobs. And then what really put her over the top was she covered the Sam Shepard trial. A lot of young people don't recognize that, but that was the trial in Cleveland that gave rise to the fugitive, the TV story and the movie. This whole idea of a doctor whose wife is murdered, and did he or didn't he kill her?
Doris passed in 2015. But what do you think she'd say about a reporting fellowship in her honor?
So I kind of think Doris would be thrilled by it. She might be a little embarrassed that we're naming for her, but she was a reporter who put herself out there quite a lot. So if you think about the kind of work she did when she was in Cleveland and in Greensburg with the Trib, she was always doing stories that were kind of pushing the boundaries and doing things that people weren't thinking about. And that's what we're really trying to do with the award as well.
So what sorts of projects then do you have in mind?
Yeah, so we're hoping that a journalist, you know, or a news organization somewhere across the United States will take this fellowship as a challenge to come up with something really creative and different. The issue of news deserts might be something that doesn't resonate with all your listeners. These are places that used to have newspapers and or other local news outlets, and they just don't any longer. And so if you think of the city of McKeesport here in Pittsburgh, it's a perfect example where this was a city that had the daily news for 130 plus years, and then it closed at the end of 2015. And now you've got a city of 20,000 residents that no longer has local news. And yeah, sure, they're within the Pittsburgh media market, but they don't, you know, the Pittsburgh stations and newspapers don't go down to McKeesport that often to tell stories. And so the people who live there look around and they say, well, where do we get our news? Where do we find out about obituaries? Where do we find out about what's going on for better or for worse in our community? Where's the accountability reporting? And the sort of frightening or eye-opening thing is that these places have just exploded all across the country as news outlets have shrunk or gone out of business.
And Point Park, of course, intimately involved, at least in McKeesport News, with some teens and a project there.
Yeah, so at Point Park, the Center for Media Innovation, the space that I run, we went down to McKeesport. We realized there was a need there, and so we got a grant from the Pittsburgh Foundation to open a community newsroom. And Martha Ryle, who's a Pulitzer Prize-winning photographer who used to work for the Post-Gazette, she's actually in McKeesport now 16 hours a week, and she's working with residents to help them start to tell their own stories. Like, if nobody else is going to be there, if there's no longer a newspaper or a news outlet, then the residents really have to take responsibility for it. And the other thing that we didn't expect to see in this in McKeesport is that there is a Tube City Online, an online newspaper, and then the Mon Valley Independent. If people haven't been following that, it's a really interesting story. This newspaper that kind of grew out of the ashes from the Mon Valley, and they're making a go of it.
The genesis of that project was on a previous episode of The Confluence. We'll have a link to that on our website. This project, this $20,000, will it help cover a specific topic or area focus specifically here in Western Pennsylvania, or could it be a little bit further out?
Yes, so this is really a national competition, so it doesn't have to be linked to Western Pennsylvania at all. It just has to be something that's substantive, something that's innovative. We'd like it to involve a diverse population, either in the story creation or the story delivery. And then we'd like it to be, you know, involved with a news desert somewhere, either a place that doesn't have local news or that was within a market area that just doesn't get a lot of coverage.
When we say innovative, it's this word that gets thrown around. Do you have any idea what you want to see? Do you just want to be blown away by something?
Yeah, no, I mean, I would love to be blown away. That's always exciting. and innovative, you're right, it is sort of the buzzword or catchword for higher ed these days. What we have in mind, we'd like to see somebody doing something that's different. You know, maybe it's doing converged media where you're bringing together written words and photography and video. That could be powerful. Or maybe you're doing something that engages the community in a different way. Like, I would love to see a situation where a reporter is actually working with the people being covered to tell the stories. I think that would be really innovative and different. Definitely multimedia. That's the other thing. Like, I would love to see it include, like, spoken word. Like, let's do a Hamilton for, you know, your neighborhood or whatever. Or let's do, you know, do a dinner or do some sort of a dance or something. Something that's going to be different.
So what will the requirements be for the ultimate winner?
Yes, so we are asking them to come to Pittsburgh because with the university, we're obviously trying to educate young people as well. And so we're asking the winner to come to Pittsburgh one time in the fall to meet with students, one time in the early spring. And then in April of next year, we will invite the person back to talk about their work. And they'll do a presentation at the Pittsburgh Playhouse where they'll talk about what they did and why it was so awesome.
And you've got a panel of five judges lined up, a couple of media experts, former Tribune Review colleague, an investigative reporter out of Cincinnati, and Pittsburgh's own Brenton Mock. What will they and Point Park be looking for in these applications?
Yeah, so we're actually going to score all of the candidates. We put an open call out to people on campus. So some of the faculty and students are going to help us score the candidates when they first come in. So we get a feel for who's really good and can present the judges some direction in case we get an overwhelming number of entries, which we hope we do. And then the judges themselves, we've created a rubric where they're going to be judging them on worthiness, this idea of innovation, the diversity issue, and then the news deserts issue. And ultimately, is this this kind of story that will have an impact? And I think that's really going to be the determining factor. Are you doing something that's going to have a lasting impact?
Andrew Conte is the director of Point Park University's Center for Media Innovation. Their new $20,000 Doris O'Donnell Innovations in Investigative Reporting Fellowship is open for applications through June 30th. The winner will be announced in September. Andy, thanks so much for making time.
Thanks for having me on.
I'm Megan Harris. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. Next time, there could be movement on the long-delayed redevelopment of the new Granada block in the Hill District. We'll talk with Marimba Malines, CEO of the Hill Community Development Corporation. If you missed anything from today's program or you'd like to catch up on past shows, please visit wesa.fm/confluence or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Today's program was engineered and produced by Kylie Kaczynski, production assistance by Julia Zenkovich and Avery Keatley. The editor and producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.